Seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 10-0581, Ole Taws III versus Doris Barnes.
May it please the court, Mr. Skelton will present argument for the appellant. Appellant has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Russell Post and I are proud to be here today on behalf of Ole Taws. Mr. Taws was the losing party in a judgment of the bankruptcy court back in 2006. It was appealed to the Federal District Court in Victoria, lost again. We appealed then to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and sometimes I've felt like a voice crying in the wilderness, but we have a certification opinion from the Fifth Circuit which sent three questions to this court. Those three questions have varying jurisprudential impact. However, they are all, the first two are case dispositive. But I'd like to start with the second, because it is potentially, it's a game over question as far as we're concerned. Barnes will lose, and yet it can be decided on a narrow basis. The second question has to do with whether the provisions of the working interest unit agreement executed by my client, other investors, Moose Oil and Gas, and Dominion, has a provision 5, which simply eliminates any potential cause of action against any party other than Dominion. Our position is Moose Oil and Gas. Our position is that if Dominion had any claim, it would have only been against Moose Oil and Gas. That Moose Oil and Gas was the liable and responsible party. If that is the case, then even if Barnes prevails on her theory that she could be a third-party beneficiary of the joint operating agreement, then she still comes up against a shut door, because she can rise no higher than the rights that Dominion would have had against Moose Oil and Gas.
The problem with that is it just doesn't seem to make any sense, because Moose was non-consenting.
Moose was a non-consenting
party. So why should you look to the non-consenting party to be paid something that the non-consenting party doesn't care whether you get paid or not?
Well, Moose was a consenting party, Your Honor. Dominion was the only non-consenting
party.
But
you have to look through Dominion to get to Moose, do you not, or not?
Your Honor, the non-consenting parties, and I think it might be helpful to look at the bench exhibit that we've submitted. First, you have in the upper right-hand corner, Doris Barnes. She's the lessor of the property in question.
And Dominion was non-consent.
Dominion was the lessee, and it went non-consent.
But that's the only person she has an agreement.
She has no agreement with anyone other than Dominion. That's correct. However, whether Dominion goes non-consent or not, Dominion is liable to Ms. Barnes because it has privity of contract and privity of estate with her. So in other words, Dominion's liability to Barnes, it's there no matter what. The joint operating agreement doesn't change it. The working interest unit agreement doesn't change it. Barnes cannot get around the fact that Dominion was her lessee. She could have always gone against Dominion. She did go against Dominion, but she settled, got enough money, and then tried to shake down Mr. Taws, who has no privity of contract, no privity of estate, and no dealings with her.
And on that subject, I'm a little unclear. Don't we have to take from the bankruptcy court's ruling that she has not been paid through the settlement?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what the bankruptcy court says is that the settlement didn't characterize how the money should be applied.
Right.
But what we're saying is, Your Honor, dollar for dollar, she got paid every bit of the $291,846 that's at issue here.
But she was claiming a million.
She was claiming a million. People can claim a lot of things,
but there was
no basis for that.
But she had other claims, and the bankruptcy court said, well, you can't tell that this is for royalty, so don't we have to take that it was not paid for royalty?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think, frankly, he just established that I didn't make a record as to what the funds were applied to. But in terms of whether we should feel sorry for poor Ms. Barnes, she didn't get any money. She got a settlement which, dollar for dollar wise, paid those unpaid royalties. She had a lot of other claims.
But if she hadn't gotten that settlement, your position would still be the same.
We don't owe her any money.
Right.
Absolutely.
And does that mean that you will get your share of production free of the burden of royalty that it would ordinarily be impressed with?
I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor, because here's the reality of how this operation works. Here's how it happens in the oil and gas business. My client's a non-operator. The operator has full control over all operations. The operator, in fact, in this case, had a contract with a purchaser of gas. The operator, which was an affiliate of Moose Oil and Gas, Moose Operating, sold the gas, collected the money. My client never saw a penny of the royalty stream money that otherwise would have gone to Ms. Barnes. That never happens. The royalty, the non-operating working interest owners are in a completely different situation. They just get a net check. The operator collects the money from the sale of gas. If there are sums owed for working interest amounts that are owed for equipment, et cetera, they net it out, you get your net check. Mr. Taws never had any control, and I want the court to particularly understand that, because there has been suggestion in other courts that there should be a sympathy factor. You know, Taws ran off with the money. Never happened. He just got his share.
Well, is his share net of the royalties that would have been paid to Mrs. Barnes?
Absolutely.
Okay, so what happened to the royalties that would have ordinarily been paid to Mrs. Barnes? Who got it?
Moose Oil and Gas, the company that ended up, frankly, for want of a better word, absconding with the money, not spending it on other things.
Okay, well,
and
let
not
me
paying
ask you this. How do you know that Moose kept the money instead of sending part of it to Taws?
Well, we know that, Your Honor, because
Mrs. Barnes' money, that is.
The reason we know that is that Taws never received the money. And
he received some money.
He received his working interest share, his net revenue interest share. In other words, not including her money.
Okay, so how does the record show that none of her money flowed to him?
All right, actually,
Moose.
There is an order that was entered by Judge Steen. I can get the record reference during the other side, but bottom line is he found, it wasn't in the main order that disposed of the issue at hand today, he found that Moose Oil and Gas had the contract, it collected the money, and it didn't pay the royalty. It is in the record.
Okay, but did he take any, what I'm wondering is this, does the record show that Moose did not distribute any of that royalty stream to its, to Taws and the other interest owners here?
What the record reflects is that Moose collected the money, Moose did not pay Barnes, and that the only two checks that were written to pay Barnes royalty from these wells, they're also part of the record, and I can get you the references to those two checks.
Okay, but we're missing each other somehow. Does the record show, is there a determination that when Moose got the money over here, because they got the money, because Dominion is not consenting, Moose collected the money. It could have sent some back up to Mrs. Barnes, which she had coming from someone. What did it do with her money that it didn't send back up there? Did it send it out to its distributees?
There is not an exhibit in the record that shows that Taws didn't get the money. It's just frankly never been an issue in dispute. I mean, Moose took the money. The only money Taws ever got was attributable to his share. And that's
simple. There's nothing to show that his share, as he received, excluded any of the money that should have gone to Mrs. Barnes.
The way this operating agreement works, that's not the way it happens. The operator pays the royalty. That's simply the way it works.
Okay, but my question is, as I understand what you're telling me, there's nothing in here that says that you can say he did not get any of the money that should have gone to Mrs. Barnes.
No, I can't think of a specific exhibit that shows that he did not receive that royalty, but he did not receive that royalty. I mean, that's been the record we've dealt with all the way up. What we're going to show, Your Honors, is that it's not just provision 5 of the working interest unit agreement that compels the result that Barnes has no claim against Taws, but only would have had a claim against Moose Oil and Gas. These agreements are not in conflict with each other, and there was a line in the Fifth Circuit certification opinion that gives me pause to think that there might have been some confusion about that. We don't contend that the working interest unit agreement trumps the joint operating agreement. We contend that they're in harmony with each other, and I'll demonstrate why. First of all, Moose Oil and Gas was designated as the responsible and liable party in the working interest unit agreement, which is signed by all of the parties who are denominated as the Moose investors, including TAWS.
Let me make sure I follow your point about provision 5. It says Moose shall be the liable party to the operator for the entire 46% working interest. Mm-hmm. And Barnes' property was pooled, notwithstanding an express no pooling clause. Her property constituted over 50% of the 640 acres. This says Moose is responsible for the entire 46% working interest. How does that relate to the 54% that Barnes' property constituted?
No, I think the 54% you're referring to is actually Dominion's share. In other words, the Moose parties had 46% of the working interest. Dominion had 54%. It has nothing to do with Baker or Barnes. It has nothing to do with how much Ms. Barnes' property comprised of the unit. The 54% is actually, there was another party with Dominion called SizeGen, that Dominion later acquired its share. So you have 47% of Dominion, 6.75% for SizeGen. That's where you get to the 54. So that's where the 54% is. The way it meshes into the joint operating agreement, notice the signature page on the joint operating agreement. The signature page bears only the signatures of Moose Oil and Gas, SizeGen, and Dominion, not any of the parties denominated as the Moose parties, including TAWS. And that's not just a coincidence. It's all part of the scheme. The scheme is that Moose Oil and Gas is undertaking the responsibility for the parties that signed the working interest unit agreement. Another example of this is found in Exhibit A attached
to... So you're saying a third-party beneficiary always has to sign a contract?
No. What I'm saying is, and I'm talking here about TAWS, who was one of these Moose investors for whom Moose Oil and Gas said it will undertake and protect them from and be the responsible and liable party. TAWS and the other parties, and if you look at your bench exhibit, who are listed along the bottom of the exhibit, none of them signed the joint operating agreement. Then when you go to Exhibit A to the joint operating agreement, that is the exhibit which is a lawyered exhibit. It's not part of the form, and it is the sharing percentages of the parties to the joint operating agreement. And what you'll find when you look at this at the Exhibit A to the joint operating agreement, you'll see SizeGen, you'll see Dominion, and you'll see Moose Oil and Gas, 46%. Now, in the working interest unit agreement, they made a distinction between Moose Oil and Gas and the parties, the other parties denominated as Moose. If they had intended to show that TAWS and the other parties should be included on Exhibit A and have liability under the joint operating agreement, they would have done so. They did not. This was a bargain for agreement involving three kinds of parties that are very typical in the oil and gas business. Dominion didn't want to fool with all these non-operators. It wanted to just deal with Moose, so it suited them to have Moose take on that responsibility. Moose wanted to get the investors, like TAWS. So naturally, it wanted to offer them protection. I'll be the responsible and liable party. It all makes sense. So we believe that Issue 2 is a trump card. TAWS wins on Issue 2. We frankly think Issue 3 is a no-brainer jurisprudentially. There is no way on God's green earth TAWS, as a 13% working interest owner, could possibly be jointly and severally liable for all of the debt. So we'll rely on our brief, and Mr. Post will follow up. Our main distinction on third-party beneficiary, and of course, time is eluding me and I want to get right to the point, is this. This case is not at all like Stein versus Stewart. Stein versus Stewart was a case in which an agreement incident to divorce provided that the parties to the divorce would pay Ms. Stein, who loaned them money to buy their house, a specific sum of money from a specific source. That is a far cry from what we have here, where we have various categories of expenses. And Stein versus Stewart makes the distinction that will, I think, influence the court to rule that there couldn't possibly be a third-party beneficiary situation. This case is more like Brown versus Fullenwater, which was a divorce case in which the parties agreed to allocate categories of expenses between them. That's what happened here. There were just categories of expenses rather than a direct promise to pay a sum certain to a particular person, and Ms. Barnes' name will not be found anywhere in any of these agreements. Out of time?
Yes, counsel. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the appellee.
The court, Mr. Watt, will present argument for the appellee.
Court, I have distributed a packet to you. There's six pages, each with a number in the right-hand corner, red. Very sophisticated system. If I say turn to page two, please turn to page two. I do it for two reasons. One, so I can read it. Two, when I've been an arbitrator before, I like to make notes on things. Anyway, you have the paper in front of you. That's what I'm referring to when I say that. Let's go, I guess, to the third-party beneficiary, creditor beneficiary part first. I think Mrs. Barnes' position is obviously exactly as Mrs. Stein's was in Stein versus Stewart. First off, let's look at what Judge Rainey's opinion called the non-consent royalty provision. It says, during the time consenting parties are entitled to receive non-consenting parties' share of production, consenting parties shall be responsible for the payment of all royalty applicable to the non-consenting party's share of production. That means that in this instance, the Barnes lease, Justice Wainwright did allow pooling, but it had a clause that said a bunch of things had to be done before it could happen. And so they got an amendment to the Barnes lease, and so it was pooled, and its acreage comprised 54% of the unit, and the Moose leases comprised 46% of the unit. Therefore, Mrs. Barnes' royalty was reduced from 17.126 down to 9.675%. Therefore, had Dominion participated, Dominion would have gotten 54% of the money. Let's say in a month it was $100 to make the math easy. Dominion would have got $54. But out of that would come $9.67 that goes as royalty to Mrs. Barnes.
Help me out here. How's this like the Stein's case? I mean, that seems very, very simplistic. You've got the Stein case you referenced early in your argument.
Yes, sir.
It seems too simplistic for this. I mean, you just had a husband and wife got a divorce. They agreed to pay the mother what she gave them for the house and wasn't paid. I mean, this is a little more complex than that.
Well, it's a little more complex. I agree. But let's look at number three for Stein. Okay. The promise when a party goes non-consent under the operating agreement. The promise is that the consenting parties promise the non-consenting parties that they will pay the royalty attributable to the non-consenting party's share. Dominion only had one lease contributed to this unit, the Barnes lease. As I stated earlier, Dominion got 54% and had to pay a 9.675% royalty. When Dominion went non-consent, that meant that the 54% that would have gone to Dominion goes to Moose and Taws, okay? Of course, the 9% royalty is still due to Mrs. Barnes. Now, to get to your point, in the Stein case, there's the definition at 80 Southwest 2nd 589. An agreement benefits a creditor beneficiary if under the agreement that performance will come to him in satisfaction of a legal duty owed to him by the promisee. Right below that, I have it sketched out here. Here are the consenting parties, Moose, Taws, Moose et al., is the promisor and promises the non-consenting party, Dominion, to pay the royalty owed under the Barnes lease, which is a legal duty of promisee or Dominion. Thus, Barnes is a creditor beneficiary.
But one thing that is very clear in our case law is that the parties to the agreement have to intend that there be a third-party beneficiary. And the only argument I see in your briefs about where that intent is evidenced was at pages 12 to 13 in your brief, where you say that the parties to the agreements, the two agreements, intended this to happen so that Dominion, not being a non-consenting party, would not get sued. But Dominion's going to get sued anyway, right?
Not if they pay all the royalty. If the consenting parties pay all the royalty to Mrs. Barnes, Dominion never gets sued.
Well, you say, thus this language demonstrates the party's intent to pay Ms. Barnes her royalty as the only guaranteed way to protect the non-consenting party, Dominion, from being sued. But it seems to me that since Mrs. Barnes' only agreement is with Dominion, they're going to get sued whether the royalty, I mean, if there's any non-payment of royalty, they're going to get sued. Because that's who she has to look to get sued.
Well, remember.
To get paid.
First off, and they say this, they argue that even Dominion couldn't sue under this. Dominion couldn't sue Moose, okay?
Which I'm not sure I understand, but it's still seems to me that your only argument for intent is to keep Dominion from getting sued, and I don't see any way to keep Dominion from getting sued.
Well, the way to keep Dominion from getting sued is for the non-consenting parties to live up their agreement to pay Mrs. Barnes the royalty. That's what keeps Dominion from getting sued.
But that is the only argument about intent, I take it.
Well, yes. Now, let's continue looking at number three. This court said in Stein, a third-party beneficiary does not have to show that the signatories executed the contract solely to benefit her as a contracting non-contracting party. Obviously, Mrs. Barnes is not the sole beneficiary here. Rather, and this is the key, the focus is on whether the contracting parties intended, at least in part, to discharge an obligation owed to a third party. If you put the proper focus here, the focus is on the promising parties promising Dominion that they will fulfill its legal obligation, which is the royalty to Mrs. Barnes. That's what they promise. Dominion is obligated to pay the royalty. The consenting parties promise Dominion they will pay it. They didn't.
She's a third-party beneficiary. And maybe you can sketch out a different view of this. I assume you do have a different view, that the whole structure was organized such that, you know, the working interest owners, they didn't want to run the show. They wanted, and Moose said, because it got them on board as investors, we'll take care of that. So look to Moose. We'll provide those protections as Moose to the working interest owners. And under Provision 5, that's where the buck stops. And he says it makes sense, the structure as he laid it out. Do you agree with that structure? I know you agree with the conclusion, but was it structured differently from your perspective?
Here's what Provision 5 means to me. It says, Moose shall be the liable party to the operator for the entire 46% working interest. And then the sentence that follows that says it'll be the responsible party for each of said party to the operator for obtaining and delivering elections. I'm on number one now. Elections, notices, invoices, payments, and billings. All right. In the next sentence, it says, should one or more of the Moose parties decide not to participate in a proposed operation? Well, that automatically, the only place that is covered is in the attached operating agreement, which under four says will govern this, okay? Once you get to the non-consent part of the operating agreement, the non-consent, which is Article 6B2, you no longer have operator, non-operator. You have consenting parties and non-consenting parties. Now, to your question, what they are saying is that Dominion signed this working interest unit agreement and agreed that despite a whole bunch of people who are identified as Moose in the preamble to it, that Dominion agreed that it would not look to any of those people for payment. What this provision is obviously for is let's say that Dominion was going to drill a well for $1 million. It needs $460,000 from Moose. Dominion didn't want to go investor by investor by investor by investor to pick it up. It said, Moose, you do it. There is nothing in here anywhere that says, and if there's a non-consent situation, then, and Dominion goes non-consent, then we won't look to anybody but Moose to pay the royalty to our share. In fact, Justice Wainwright, when you have the paragraph under Provision 5, I'm still on page 1, down at the bottom, when that allows the Moose parties to participate or not participate, and that puts them in the same status as everybody else. They can propose operations, they can do anything that any other non-operator can. They are non-operators under the operating agreement. Here they become consenting parties. To say that Dominion, by this language in Provision 5, meant to change the non-consent provisions of Article 6B2 without saying so stretches me a lot. You wrote the opinion, Justice Wainwright.
So you think Dominion could have sued Taws?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Because Taws was a consenting party and Dominion was a non-consenting party.
Right. And so couldn't this current situation have been avoided if you simply took an assignment from Dominion of its right to sue Taws?
You mean if Dominion had assigned a cause of action to Mrs. Barnes?
Yes.
I suppose so, yes.
And that would be preferable to trying to figure out if every royalty owner is a third-party beneficiary of these kinds of agreements.
We're not saying that every royalty owner is a beneficiary of these kinds of agreements. We're trying to say the one provision in this agreement that addresses non-consent provisions, that the royalty owner is a third-party creditor beneficiary of that. Under the Stein language that I just read, and I just it's on number 3 here. Justice Wainwright, you wrote this court's opinion in Balance v. Dorsett, and it involved a non-consent clause, but it was a different issue. You'll recall it was a proposing party made a proposal for a well. The party receiving it didn't respond during the 30-day period. They're deemed to be non-consenting because of that. Then the proposing party went ahead and within that period drilled the well. The other party sued for breach of contract, saying you drilled the well within the 30 days. You said, in your opinion, rejecting that claim, that there is no language in the agreement that forbids the commencing of a well within 30 days. In other words, that language isn't there. There is no language in this agreement that says that if in a consent, non-consent situation, that only Moose will be liable. There's just not language in this agreement. And to read the language on Provision 5 to modify Article 6B2 of the attached joint operating agreement, I just don't see the connection.
Let me ask you this. Suppose in this case, I know this is an issue, but suppose it was undisputed in answer to Justice Johnson's question earlier that Taws was paid only net of the royalty obligation. That's all Taws received. In your view of the case, Mrs. Barnes could still sue Taws to recover her royalty payment.
Correct.
So that Taws would, as an investor, would end up paying the royalty twice, basically.
No, not necessarily. He would. You're saying, well, first, if she had already been paid all of her royalty, he wouldn't have to pay it twice. That's the whole thing.
No, if Moose ran off with the money.
Right.
And so Ms. Barnes doesn't get paid.
Right.
But Taws only gets what he would have gotten net of the royalty.
Right.
That's all he gets from Moose.
Right.
If you can sue Taws for the royalty, he has to pay the royalty twice.
Well, that's exactly. That's part of the being jointly and severally liable for the non-consenting party's royalty obligation. I mean, that's what that means.
Right.
And the reason that Dominion would have bargained for that joint and several liability is again, they wouldn't want to have happen what did happen, and that's that one of the parties wouldn't pay. That was Moose. They went bankrupt. And the rest would, because in that event, they're going to get sued by the royalty owner. In the words of Justice Rainey, Judge Rainey, on page 14 of his opinion, it's not surprising that the non-consenting parties bargained for maximum protection. For that reason, this is what you and I were talking about earlier on not getting sued and getting sued. I mean, to me, this is a contractual limitation between sophisticated parties. One of them says, if I don't participate in an operation and you're going to get all my interest until there's a certain financial threshold is met, I want to make sure that the royalty gets paid so that I'm not obligated to pay it and I don't get sued for not paying it. And that's the reason for this, and I don't see why sophisticated businessmen cannot make an agreement like this. In fact, if there were anything, I've heard the sky is falling in this case, that if you rule in favor of Mrs. Barnes, there's going to be chaos across the oil and gas industry. I think probably the most chaotic thing you could do would be to say that the Dominion can't enforce a non-consent royalty provision like this when they go non-consent.
And of course, but to say that Dominion can and Taws can Barnes can are two different things.
Sir?
To say Dominion can and that Barnes can are two different things. I mean, I don't think anybody disagrees that Dominion could enforce it. They're all parties to the agreement, but the question is whether Mrs. Barnes can enforce it.
Well, that is the question, whether she's a third-party beneficiary, and that's what I think she's exactly under Stein v. Stewart, because Dominion owed her a legal obligation, and the consenting parties, including Taws, agreed to fulfill that legal obligation of Dominion. That is the definition, and that is, to quote Stein v. Stewart again, that is the proper focus here. And this agreement, or two agreements viewed as a whole, which everybody agrees they should be construed together, I think that's a fair reading, and certainly Judge Rainey and Judge Steen did. Now, there's one thing I want to address. When Mr. Skelton was up here, we tried this case in the bankruptcy court, and this entire proceeding emanates from that, on stipulated facts. I heard a bunch of stuff that isn't in those stipulated facts about who got what money, that sort of thing. The stipulated fact was that under the Baker 1 and 2 wells, Mrs. Barnes was short, under those two wells, $291,000 in royalty. That is stipulated, okay? Now, if you've got to look at this way, it's the simplest way of looking at it. Taw's only claim, his only right to take the minerals from underneath Mrs. Barnes' land is the Dominion lease. How can Taws continue to take money off that lease when she's short? And she never signed any of these agreements. She signed an oil and gas lease with Dominion. How can Taws continue to take money when she is short? Could Dominion do that? Of course not. Dominion would have to pay her the $291,000. Taws should be no different. Joint and several liability is the presumed position. If you go to number four, it's black letter law that if you have multiple promisors, which we have here, the consenting parties, to a single promise, that is to pay the royalty, then there is a presumption that is joint and several unless it's specifically negated. It is not. The entire non-consenting royalty clause never negates a several joint, this never says anything about several liability.
Okay, well, counsel, there are several places in the agreement, though it seems as though where it says, for example, all losses incurred shall be borne by the parties in proportion to their interests, and then it seems like that is carried through. Your position is that Mr. Tawes has to pay the entire royalty.
Under the non-consenting situation only, you're right, Justice Johnson. Normally, the parties don't. It is a several liability. I agree with you completely. But under that one situation where one party is giving up its entire interest, that agreement made between the consenting parties and the non-consenting parties is that the consenting parties have to pay all of the non-consenting parties' royalty obligation.
And that explanation applies as well to Article 7A of the JOA, where it says the liability of the parties shall be several, not joint or collective?
Absolutely, it does.
Explains it as well?
Absolutely, it does, because otherwise, you're always going to have a non-consenting party, and so that interest is out, and so you're never going to have 100% of the consenting parties. So it's got to be that way, and it's just the mechanism that the parties designed to accommodate this situation. My time is up unless there are questions.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Watts.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Post will present the rebuttal for the appellant.
Court, I think that Justice Hecht has the central issue in the case on the third party beneficiary test exactly right, and that's what we believe is dispositive here. The court requires an unambiguous statement of an intent to confer a direct benefit on a third party to recognize third party beneficiary standing, and there's a presumption against third party beneficiary standing. And there is no explicit statement anywhere in the joint operating agreement of an intention to confer a benefit directly on a third party. In fact, counsel has acknowledged in his brief and acknowledged again today to the court the purpose of this provision in Article 6B2, upon which they rest their claim, is to protect the interests of the operators with respect to non-operators and to respect the interests of the consenting parties with respect to non-consenting parties. It is not directly to benefit the royalty owner. It would be a classic case of an incidental benefit at best that does not meet the court's plain statement rule to confer third-party beneficiary standing. What this provision is working on in Article 6B2 is an allocation of expenses internally among the parties to the joint operating agreement. It has nothing to do with the obligations owed to third parties. And in fact, in that sense, the case is much more like Brown versus Fullenwider, this court's third party beneficiary decision, in which parties had agreed to allocate expenses between themselves and had no intention to confer direct benefit on a third party, and the court rejected third party beneficiary standing. I also think for that reason, it falls classically into this court's line of cases from the construction contracts and the retainage cases, which counsel never answered in his brief, didn't answer here again today. And in Corpus Christi Bank, in Citizens National Bank, and in that long line of cases, this court has consistently held third-party trade creditors cannot be intended creditor beneficiaries of a retainage provision, a construction contract, because those provisions are designed to protect the principal parties, to protect the property owner from any liens on the property, not to confer a benefit on the third parties. That's exactly what's at work here in Article 6B2. This provision is an internal accounting provision that is not intended to affect the rights of a third party. And for that reason, it doesn't provide third-party beneficiary standing. In addition, I think important with respect to the way that works is Justice Wainwright's question about Article 7A and the way in which liabilities are allocated to the parties in Article 7. Because Article 7 governs allocations of liabilities, and Article 7C makes explicit that the operator pays expenses and they're charged to the joint account. And in the accounting procedures that are attached to the JOA, it's Exhibit C to the JOA, in Section 2.2, The accounting procedures make clear the operator pays expenses and charges those expenses to the joint account. And that has two consequences. Number one, it confirms that this provision in Article 6B2 simply is determining internal accounting among the parties to the JOA with respect to obligations such as expenses that are paid by the operator. And Article 7C confirms the royalties are part of those expenses. This is not a third-party beneficiary situation. But the second consequence it has is it underscores the point with respect to Issue 2, that even if there could be a third-party beneficiary claim here, that claim could lie only against Moose because Moose was the operator. Now, much of the discussion today has focused on the second prong of that argument.
Let me ask you this. If she is a third-party beneficiary,
yes.
What's your position on joint and several?
Well, my position on joint and several is that it's unthinkable, given the language of this agreement, that there could be joint and several liability. And the reason is that every provision that speaks to this issue makes clear liability is several. Article 6B2 itself, the provision upon which they rely, says that the entire cost and risk of these operations will be borne by the consenting parties in the proportions they elect to bear. And then Article 7A, as Justice Wainwright recognizes, makes clear that the liability is always several. So I think there's no question here that the manifested intention of the parties is only for several liability. Turning back then to Article 7C and the consequence of this provision that makes the operator responsible for the payment of these expenses, I want to make sure that the court doesn't misunderstand our answer to question two. It doesn't depend only on Article 5 of the Working Interest Unit Agreement. It also fits hand in glove with the provisions in Article 7 that say the operator pays expenses. Because what that means is that if there is a third-party beneficiary claim here, it could lie only against the party that had the obligation under the contract. It is bedrock third-party beneficiary law that a third party never has greater rights than the contract provides. This contract provided only for the operator to fulfill the royalty obligations. The claim lies only against the operator, and TAWS is not the operator. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That the cause is submitted. This concludes arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.